tree, but for the thought. I mean, this is extraordinarily important research. So that's when I would talk about Mikoyan, what was he like? It was that he was somebody who ultimately he had convictions. He was somebody who believed in kind of a, I guess you could say, a kind of a democratic socialism. And at the same time, it was somebody who was, you know, relatively easygoing man. He didn't like violent solutions to problems. So in the case of Hungary, he didn't want to have Soviet troops, you know, crush the revolution. He'd rather have talks. Same thing in Novocherkassk. Khrushchev sent him there with Frol Kozlov, and Mikoyan wanted to talk to the workers. But Kozlov said, no, we should put this down with force. They absolutely mow him down. And that actually tells you, you know, quite a bit about him. Also, the way he dealt with Chechnya, the way he dealt with these national republics. So that's kind of Mikoyan in a nutshell.
Yeah. What is your favorite Mikoyan story?
My favorite Mikoyan story is when he's negotiating with Che Guevara in Cuba. And Che is very, very intransigent in the negotiations. He's taking a very hard position. And Mikoyan basically, you know, at one point he's very frustrated. And Mikoyan says, you know, now I know why they call you Che, because Che means no in Armenian. So it's like, this is one of those stories, you know. Or the other story, there was another story where Mikoyan is translator Leonov. They were in Mexico City. And suddenly opening of the Soviet exhibition in Mexico City. And there's this woman who comes up to Mikoyan and begins speaking to him in a language that Leonov has no idea. This Nikolai Leonov has no idea he knows Spanish, but he doesn't know what language this woman is speaking. So Mikoyan turns to Leonov and he says, translate. And Leonov says, Anastas Ivanovich, I don't know this language. That this is like some language of the Indians of southern Mexico. I don't know what this is. And Mikoyan left and he told Leonov, you passed the honesty test, that she was actually a representative of the Armenian community of Mexico. And she was welcoming me to this whole thing. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, there are many stories I could tell from this book. I mean, I pack it in with anything interesting.
Finally, you know, we're in a time of rising nationalism and ethnic conflict, particularly in the region that we're interested in, Eastern Europe, former Soviet space.
Well, even in America, I mean,
or in America, excuse me, you're absolutely right. My bad. Pretty much everywhere, let's say. The way you tell his story, particularly around nationality policy, it's very interesting and very, I would say, refreshing in many cases, because he tries to do this, as I say, I called it a dance of recognizing, but at the same time, not going too far, like trying to figure this out. What can Mikoyan teach us today?
Mikoyan can teach us that it's good to respect our differences, appreciate our differences without using those differences to foster some kind of division among us, right? This idea of, even though, I mean, there is this element of myth in the Soviet Druzhba Narodov, right? I mean, we don't need to say it, but it wasn't completely myth, as I mentioned in the book, that people did have friendships in this period of time. People did have intermarriage in this period of time. Mikoyan actually he went to Baku. He had a great reception in Baku. He met with rehabilitated old Bolsheviks in Baku. Extraordinary meeting. And I was very fortunate to find the transcript of this in Garf. I mean, and it was actually Mikoyan in this transcript was being very frank about his own feelings about the legacy of Stalinism, about his own kind of guilt or his role in Stalinism. But in any case, the point is that what can he teach us today? He can teach us that, you know, it's nice to be nice, right? The idea that, you know, you have to be tolerant of, we all have differences, but that we all can, you know, I guess you could say coexist. No matter who you are, if you are Armenian, or Azerbaijani, Georgian, Russian, Ukrainian, whatever, that a lot more unites us than divides us, right? And that's a story that's not only relevant for the post-Soviet countries, but really for our world today, in which we're hurting a lot in many places, from Gaza to Washington, D.C., to Tehran, to all, I mean, everything. And so that's, I think, the overall message we can get from this, that there's room for diversity.
That was Pietro Shakarian. Pietro Shakarian is a historian of Russia and the Soviet Union and a lecturer at the American University of Armenia in Yerevan. He is the author of Anastas Mikoyan, an Armenian reformer in Khrushchev's Kremlin, published by Indiana University Press.
Thank you very much, Rusana. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
This is the Eurasian Knot, which is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. And listeners just like yourselves, help us out, spread the word about the podcast, become a patron, share it on social media, bring all your friends and family to listen. And I should also mention that this episode, like all our episodes, was edited and mixed by Daniel Cooper at Podcuts Editing. I guess that's it for this week. You feel discombobulated today? I feel discombobulated.
You do? Why?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'm anticipating game two of the NBA finals. This is why I'm like done with the day. So, yeah.
You're done with the day. You're in a full anticipation mode. I find it so endearing when people take sports seriously.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I love it. So, well, anyways, until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye. Утренний дурной ходит и точит кинжалы, а потом ее трезвит, чтоб не убежала. Карапет влюбился в красотку Тамару, ты душа любезный. Совсем не под пару. Ты цветочка кроза родного Кавказа.
Hello and welcome to the Eurasian Knot. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
The Eurasian Knot is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, and you lovely patrons out there who give us monthly contributions to help us keep this podcast running. As I've said repeatedly in the last couple of months, your generous donations are increasingly important. So please consider becoming a patron by going to patreon.com/eurasianknot or to the podcast website, eurasianknot.org, and find the link to Patreon and sign up and just give us a few bucks. It's very helpful. So how are things on your end?
Oh, things are going pretty well. The semester is drawing to a close.
Ah.
Drawing to an end. Yes, so I just have a final to proctor in a few days, which was scheduled weirdly from 7 to 11 p.m.
What?
I know. Oh, 7 to 10 p.m. It's like the last possible time slot on the last day of the semester. Yeah, and so then I have to grade those finals, and then I'm in the clear for the winter semester.
And are you teaching next semester?
Yes, I am.
And what are you teaching?
I'm teaching Foundations of Social Theory at the interdisciplinary program here.
Nice. And what's the most interesting reading you have on your syllabus?
Well, it's not my syllabus.
Well,
I'm a teaching assistant. I'm looking forward to revisiting Durkheim.
Oh.
Haven't read that one a really long time. Yeah, it's a bunch of old school people.
Oh, okay.
Weber, Durkheim. I think there is some Foucault. Yeah, I don't remember exactly what else. But yeah, it's pretty kind of pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, kind of foundations, as you said.
Yeah, classical texts. So I'm excited about that because it's actually social theory. This semester we taught Marxism and liberalism.
Oh.
And even though, I mean, obviously I find Marxism is close to my heart, but still... I was like, oh no, I don't want to talk about like surplus value anymore.
What was the, you know, what did you read about liberalism that was actually interesting?
Well, fortunately, I didn't because I was on maternity leave. I didn't have to deal with it.
Oh,
so I literally came back that week that they started talking about Marxism.
I see.
Perfect timing. Perfect timing.
That's convenient. Huh,
yeah,
okay.
But even that kind of, yeah, that got old really fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Hmm. Ah, well, that's too bad that you didn't get to revisit liberalism.
I know they read Locke, Mill, Stuart.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Yeah, also classical texts, but I was like, oh, thank God I didn't have to deal with that.
All right. Well, I'm happy to say that we have a winner for our joke contest.
Yay! Where are the...
I think I don't know. Do I have some
you need
like,
some sound machine? No, yeah.
Do I have some... No, that's not good. Let's see. Wait. Actually, you like that one.
Yeah.
Me too. Okay, that's a...
Oh, this one is pretty good too.
Oh God.
Stop, stop. Okay.
This is like giving me Super Bowl vibes.
Yeah, I don't know if I have a drum roll one, but let me see. Maybe there is a drum roll. Large robot. Oh, no, this changes my voice. Oh, no, I don't have drum. Oh, that's strange. Okay, well, I might keep some of those in. That might be fun. Anyways, the winner is a listener named Christoph, who I now know lives in Hungary because I asked him for his address to send his prize. And this is the joke he won for.
During the darker 1950s in communist Hungary, four strangers get into the same train seed box. It sounds like a beginning of a mystery novel. It's a long ride. They're bored, so they start drinking, and after a few shots, they decide that they'll pass the time by telling jokes. They take turns at telling jokes, and one of them tells a really good one about Rakosi. All four of them are laughing like mad. It takes at least 5 minutes to slowly stop laughing. One of them, still giggling, says, "Man, this was really, really good. Oh, I really need to write this down. Okay, so what's your name and your address?" Yes, this was pretty good.
This is a good one. Well, thank you, Christoph. You'll be getting a prize in the mail, hopefully sooner rather than later. I don't know what the state of mail is now with the tariffs and stuff. I don't know if this will matter. But yes, I will send you a prize. And I'll say what the prize. I don't know what the prize is.
Oh, yeah,
yet.
A prize. We're keeping the mystery.
Yeah, it's still it's a mystery prize. It's a mystery prize. Anyways, that was a lot of fun. Maybe we should do this joke contest, you know, every once in a while. And people can continue to send in jokes. And we have a bunch of backlog. We also have some sounds we need to play. So maybe once we get into the new year, we'll start picking those things up again. So... All right. So if you have a joke or a sound, you can send it to us. You can send it through our contact page at yourannot.org/contact. And if you're sending a sound, tell us what it means for you. If you're sending a joke, even, you can tell us what it means to you. And we're looking for jokes. We're looking for like jokes from communist societies. It can be from anywhere in the world, like the one that Christoph sent in and won our prize. It's about Hungary. So if you have any jokes from other communist states, we'll certainly welcome them.
Okay, why don't we jump into the interview? So this week, you interviewed Alexis Lerner about post-Soviet graffiti.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I couldn't be there because I had office hours. So I'm very curious to know, what was your favorite part of the interview?
My favorite part of the interview? Oh boy. My favorite part of the interview actually is when Alexis was talking about the types of graffiti that she really likes. Like I asked her at one point, like, what is your favorite graffiti? And she told about that. I really liked it. And I also liked her telling me a bit about these graffiti artists because she actually went around and hung out with them. She went on a couple of graffiti like painting nights. And just hearing about those kinds of people and how they do their art and what they think about it is actually really interesting to me. So that would be my favorite part.
Where did she do her research?
She did her research in St. Petersburg, Berlin. I want to say in Budapest and a couple other places. I can't remember. She has a list. So, and she's been collecting them, and she actually has a website where people can go and see the graffiti that she's taking pictures of, which is, I mean, in the hundred. I mean, the book itself has like over 100 pictures of graffiti. So it was really cool.
Wow, that's impressive. I bet they were really nice places to hang out in.
I bet. So, and you know, to hear about like, particularly in authoritarian states, like what role does graffiti play and its the politics around it and its political efficacy is something else that we talked about that I found interesting. So, yeah. All right. Well, why don't you go ahead and introduce Alexis for us?
Alexis Lerner is an assistant professor of political science at the United States Naval Academy. She's the author of Post-Soviet Graffiti, Free Speech in Authoritarian States, published by University of Toronto Press. You can see the Alexis Gallery of Graffiti at postsovietgraffiti.com. Here's Alexis Lerner.
All right, Alexis, it's great to talk to you. Thanks again for reaching out and letting me know of your book. I guess John Bushnell's book on graffiti, I mean, that's the only one I knew of. So it's just you, him and yours now?
That's right.
Okay. And his book was published, like, I have it somewhere over here on my shelf.
In 1990.
It was published a long, long time ago. So I guess this is a topic just waiting to be picked up by someone, that someone being you. And your book is called Post-Soviet Graffiti, Free Speech in Authoritarian States. And, you know, the first question I have is, why graffiti?
Thanks so much for having me. I should offer, before we start, a general disclaimer that the opinions and statements in this interview are my own and not those that reflect the U.S. Naval Academy or the Department of Defense.
So back in 2009, I was an undergraduate and I was living in St. Petersburg, Russia. And every day I would walk with my roommate along Nevsky Prospect all the way down from my apartment to St. Petersburg State University to on the island. And as we did that walk, we would see all of this graffiti, these stencils, stickers, freehand writings about jailed political prisoners, about nuclear policy, critique of nuclear policy, and so on. And it was all really free and critical of the Kremlin. And it led to these bigger questions of, well, is this just a St. Petersburg thing? Is it true beyond St. Petersburg? Is it true outside of Russia? And so I went back to the States and I went back to school and I started getting funding to go back to the region. And I ended up going all the way from Berlin in the west to Vladivostok in the east over the course of 10 years, looking at how people express themselves using graffiti, how they circumvented censorship in a variety of different types of regimes, but of course with a focus on how they do it in the most closed of regimes in the authoritarian states.
So as we were talking briefly before we started recording, your book is the only book I know of besides John Bushnell's book on Moscow graffiti from 1990, which he deals with a bit of the late Soviet period. Why don't you give us a brief history of graffiti in this region that you've looked at?
One of the coolest things about doing ethnographic work is that you, over time, talk to all of these people and you get to sort of cross-validate the stories they tell. And so one of my interviewees is this guy named Basket, right? I use their pseudonyms that they choose for themselves as graffiti artists. And Basket told me this amazing story of, it's the late Soviet era. He's sitting in a cafe in St. Petersburg. And if everybody's pretty, especially young adults, they're looking for something to do with their time. And he's sitting there all day drinking the same cup of tea. And there's a TV in the corner and they have a VHS of Beat Street. And if you've seen the movie Beat Street, it's about breakdancing in New York City. And in the back of all of the breakdancing, you see the trains of Manhattan covered in graffiti. And that was really powerful for Basket. And so he connected with his two friends. They go over to Riga where they can find, you know, the paint factory. And so they go to the paint factory and they get the paint. They bring it back to St. Petersburg. They start painting. And he tells these stories that some babushka was walking by and how she commented on what they were painting. And there wasn't this immediate aversion because there was no precedent really for it. I mean, John Bushnell, as you say, he talks about it a bit and he talks about, for example, the hippie movements as shown through graffiti and some of the nuclear movements. Certainly some of the Viktor Tsoi graffiti happening in the late Soviet era, but this real explosion of graffiti used to express political discontent and political sentiment is huge in this like early post-Soviet period. Then these guys go on to create a school of sorts, right? So they start training the next generation of artists to, and of course, they're often paid to be there. So they train the next generation of artists in how to paint and how to create something that, I guess, in 2025, we turn to YouTube or social media to do. But, you know, at that time, this happened in person. And this next sort of second-gen artists, they came to paint in a time that not only were they being trained by people who sort of learned by doing, but also they came to become artists in the time of these graffiti festivals. And these graffiti festivals were initially sponsored by these international corporations. So Nike, Nescafe, Monster Energy Drink, even the U.S. consulate at some point, I think it was in 2011, sponsored one of these. And all of these different organizations would have their own agenda, and they would bring these artists to paint a skateboard deck or a pair of shoes or whatever. They were often told, no politics, no porn. And they would create, and they would be given, you know, paint, and they would be given space to make art. Of course, they were completely taken advantage of, and these international corporations then used their products and used their art in order to make a profit overseas. So they were learning from the first wave. They were getting more experience through these festivals that were very popular at the time. That brings us to sort of the present day, where we have conservatism, nationalism, patriotism. There's a closing, a consolidation of the authoritarian state in Russia. This is post-2022. There's tensions between the U.S. and Russia. There's sanctions. There's a proxy war in Syria. There's all of these different things happening that create sort of a crackdown. And so what happens with the third wave is some of those second wave artists and even first wave artists are invited to quite literally come out of the shadows and paint on behalf of the state. These beautiful large murals about Maya Plisetskaya and like national Soviet icons and different cultural leaders, but also about military leaders. I'm sure you've seen maybe on the old Arbat, there's this big mural of General Zhukov looking out over the Arbat and sort of over Viktor Tsoi, the Tsoi wall, where people would come there and write peace-nik graffiti. And so you had these artists that were being invited to paint for the state explicitly. Anybody who wanted to create real subversive art was sort of pushed to the outskirts of society. So that's the trajectory of graffiti from the early 90s, late 80s until today.
I don't know if they talked about this at all, but I'd be curious to know if they did. You know, in the Soviet period, street art, of course, was widespread in terms of the state's propaganda. Did they reflect upon that Soviet tradition of a state-sponsored, in this case, again, street art and the kind of messages that they were trying to provoke with that propaganda?
Oh, 100%. And so we go from any, you know, a Soviet consolidated autocratic state to a post-Soviet consolidated autocratic Russia. And we see these trends from both time periods of the state using these sort of six-story murals, which dominates public space. It co-opts artists, it co-opts the art form, and it's able to control narratives. And so, yes, someone walking down the street might think, oh, that's just a pretty colorful image of Maya Plisetskaya. I did a talk a few weeks ago, and one of the women in the audience said, oh, I was...
Hello and welcome to the Eurasian Knot. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
The Eurasian Knot is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. And our lovely followers and patrons who give us money every month to let us know how much they like the show, to invest in it. And it's really helpful, too. So we can, I actually solved my audio problems. So that's part of the the benefit of yeah? Some of the patron money. Yeah, I went back to a different system and got rid of the other one. I don't know what happened to it. But at any rate, please consider becoming a patron if you're not. Go to patreon.com/youreanot or to youreanot.org and sign up, become a patron, and chip in a few bucks. Okay, so...
How are you, Sean?
Oh, how am I? I am doing... I'm doing good. I was in Princeton last week, as you know, and I went to this conference on... This is the second conference I've went to. The first one was at NYU in October. This one was organized pretty much by the same people, but it was in Princeton, which is a beautiful campus, by the way. I'd never been there before. And the conferences are bringing together academics and people who do podcasting or audio and trying to get academics to think about audio as an additional form, but also a legitimate form of knowledge production.
That sounds actually that sounds like a fun conference. What are some of your impressions?
Well, first off, for me personally, it's incredibly inspiring because I don't have to like people, we're all on the same page. Like we all see the potential that audio can do to bring academic ideas to a wider audience, to have that expression in a more creative and artistic form. And it's nice that I didn't have to, you know, you don't have to like try to convince reluctant academics to think about things in a different way. Everybody was on board there. And, you know, as I was telling you before we started, I think one of the things that people are thinking of is how do we, audio is not there to replace, say, the traditional academic study or monograph or article or whatever it may be. It's there to supplement. It's there to bring the knowledge to a different audience or to provide a creative outlet that reflects more academic work that maybe people who aren't specialists, you know, might not be interested in, right? So people are thinking in those directions. One of the issues that came up that I thought was really funny was academic concerns about peer review. And one of the participants who is a very well-known podcaster named Chenjerai Kumanyika, he's great. I highly recommend everybody listen to his series on the history of the NYPD called Empire City. He stood up and he said, you know, in the production meetings for Empire City, I got more feedback and had to do more corrections and more like revisions and more discussions than I've ever had an academic peer review. He's like, let's not fetishize it now. And I think he's right. And I think that's the other thing too. Like for me personally, what we do is such a solitary endeavor. And the audio component ideally puts you in a team situation. And I find that very exciting and quite inspiring. And it also too, like it makes me think that what you and I do here really matters. And more people are starting to do it. So we're kind of ahead of the game in some respects. So the other thing too, and this is something I've been harping on for many years, is that there is an audience out there for what we do. There are people who would be interested to hear this information and these stories. The problem is how to present it in a way that they can access it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, storytelling is a difficult trade.
It's a very difficult trade. So, so like I told you before we started, I'm going to try looking into maybe holding something like the third iteration of this conference here at Pitt, maybe in the fall. So,
that'd
hey,
be exciting.
Maybe,
yeah.
You could come.
Yeah. We made so many plans.
Yeah. So since you'll be in Michigan, you're closer. Yeah. Maybe you can, you know, if we do it in the fall or even in the winter.
I can't believe we're going to live 4 hours away from each other.
I know. Same time zone.
It's
crazy.
It's dangerous.
Yeah. So those are some of my thoughts. Of course, I could talk about this for a really long time. Unless you have any more questions, we can move on to.
Yes, let's move on to the interview, which is very fitting for this conversation because it's with Alona Ledineva, whose most recent book also uses various kinds of art forms to go along with the book, specifically images, sculpture, and sound.
Yeah, the book has a soundtrack. It's an album called The System Made Me Do It, which I just love that.
Yeah, the title is just amazing.
You can find it on Spotify, but we'll do a link to all of that as well so you can listen to the music. And as you said, I want to point out the images of the sculpture that accompany each chapter were sculptures done by her. So here is a great example of a political scientist, academic, whatever, kind of branching
Here's
out.
Here's a great example of a Renaissance woman who's good at everything.
I mean, I think it's wonderful to really exercise our creativity in these new ways.
Absolutely.
You know,
if you have the means and freedom to do so, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and of course, everyone should know about her work. She's written 3 books on blot and informality in Russia.
All right, without further ado, let me introduce Alona Ledineva. Alona Ledineva is professor of politics and society at the University College London and a founder of the Global Informality Project. She is the author of the trilogy Russia's Economy of Favors, How Russia Really Works, and Can Russia Modernize? Her new book is The Russian Pendulum, Paradoxes, Practices, and Patterns, published by UCL Press. Here's Alona Ledineva.
А потом ее 400 не убежал.
Well, Alina, it's very lovely to talk to you. I've been a longtime admirer of your books. I've also read all of them up to this point. Very influential. And you have a new one titled The Russian Pendulum, Paradoxes, Practices, and Patterns. And I, of course, was struck by the very first line of the book in the preface, which reads, "The West is obsessed with Putin, but not really interested in Russia." So why did you begin this way? And what do you mean by that?
Why? It's because I live on the top of a bookshop. And every time I look at the shelf, which is about politics or Russia or something like that, all I see is Putin. And for me, it's quite frustrating because I come from Siberia and really do not consider myself ever being interested in Moscow or wanting to be there. So never been really a political person. So it is a little ironic that I'm professor of politics now. But I also have to say that this phrase doesn't belong to me. I actually cite my esteemed colleagues, Andrew Wilson and Mark Leonard and Ivan Krastev, who first made that observation about Russian studies, which are, of course, very diasporic in nature. And when people leave Russia, they develop the attitude to Russia on the basis of Western reporting, which also normally has Putin in the titles. So, and that kind of focus on Putin leaves a blind spot, in my view, which is where my work on informality comes in.
For me, the latter part of this statement is the interesting one, in the sense of we're not interested in Russia. So you clearly, like you said, with informality, are trying to paint a different picture of Russia that decenters Putin or calls us to actually put him to the side and look at other things. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I certainly aim with this book, which arguably will be my last academic text, to go beyond Putin and think about long-term agenda for non-systemic opposition, forces which are being shaped as we think about the world once the Russia fully-fledged invasion into Ukraine stops, once we are through the regional wars that we experience at the moment in the Middle East and elsewhere. I really tried in this work to think in a longer term, starting with the patterns of modernization from the period of origins of the Russian state and looking in a very broad brush as to where the problem is, because it looks like we are stepping on the same rake, if you know that Russian expression. You make the same mistake about Russia, so much so that Russian experts came up with this paradox that the only predictable thing about Russia is its unpredictability. We also have Russia's insiders, such as Saltykov-Shchedrin, who said that every 5, 7, or 30 years, depending on the citation, everything changes significantly in Russia, but in 200 or 300, nothing changes. So that kind of paradoxical observation from the outside or by internal observers made me thinking, okay, not what's wrong with Russia, which is very often the pitch when we look at the Russian facades and the institutional structures in Russian politics, but rather think about what works and works so effectively that the institutions do not develop. And that has been my key question, not just in addressing Russia, but also as part of the Global Informality Project, where I look at the contexts with a bottom-up approach in order to sense as to how things get done and problems get solved in everyday life. by people. So my approach is, let's think out of the box. You know, let's think how we could see Russia differently. Also, not making it so unique, because what I see in the Western analysis of Russia is that Russia is seen as a kind of this peculiar monster, huge, worth digging into, interesting, but truly unique. And this exceptionism, to me, is quite problematic. And now I could say this, you know, when I did How Russia Really Works, or Can Russia Modernize, or Russia's Economy of Favors, I actually didn't question that assumption. But ever since I started working on the Global Encyclopedia of Informality, and now the Global Informality Project covers 5 continents, over 100 countries, I understand much more about uniqueness and specificity, also in the way in which I could see unique structures all over the world. They are pretty universal human ways of behavior in conditions of shortage or pressure or stress. However, those universal practices, they become localized in a context-sensitive way. So those informality patterns, they are truly glocal.
Glocal. I haven't heard that. That's a great word.
Glocality of informality. That's a new buzz word, you know.
This discussion and the discussion me and Sean had yesterday made me wonder, do you feel like ultimately this idea that Russia is always becoming, that Russia is always kind of lagging behind but trying to catch up, is this ultimately a case of Orientalism on the part of Western scholars or politicians, etc.? Would you agree or not?
Well, I didn't think about it in those terms. You know, when I talk about West-centric views of Russia, I don't mean that the analysis that we have, they are exotic in any way or orientalist in their scope or perspective. I actually teach quite a lot of political science and I use the conceptual tools. And I think it's very important way to compare Russia to the rest of the countries from political science perspective. But what my perspective adds to it is that sort of bottom-up entry point on informal praxis. Maybe I better give an example. So, for example, I came across with the 6 paradoxes of socialism. And that was really interesting for me because it's an anecdote of the Soviet times. I actually remember it. It goes as 6 paradoxes of socialism. So there is no unemployment, but nobody works. Nobody works, but productivity increases. Productivity increases, but shops are empty. Shops are empty, but fridges are full. Fridges are full, but nobody satisfied. Nobody satisfied, but everyone votes in support of the system. So give me a better definition of socialism in the Soviet period. I have not come across one. But when you look at this closely, it's quite interesting. Well, every paradox hides an informal practice that actually solves it and, you know, makes it absolutely obvious that, yes, that's a facade and a reality. So the first one, for example, there is no unemployment, but nobody works, means those multiple tea breaks and social atmosphere and infinite inability to work at full capacity because, as people used to say, they pretend they pay, we pretend we work. So it's a mutual understanding, right? It's a social contract. So every paradox, and I decode them in the book, which I don't want to do here, but maybe just to bring up the idea of blot, which spells as bacon, lettuce, and tomato, or bacon, lettuce, avocado, tomato. Depending
I didn't think
on,
of that before.
depending on your taste. But this, the LAT practices of getting favors from people you know and exchanging informal favors or circumventing formal procedures with help of personal contacts has been really instrumental to address issues of the economy of shortage.
Yeah.
And you know, the Kornay's work, Janusz Kornay's work on the economy of shortage, which pretty much has been the economic model for multiple socialisms that we had around the globe. And blood is actually complementary to that, because when you have a situation of shortage, what you do, you try to circumvent it by relying on favors from friends and relations. Mm-hmm. And that actually is not universal. I mean, that's not unique,
right,
and not specific to Russia at all. And every society we've been looking at within the Global Informality Project has an analogous practice.
And it's interesting, too, because I've mentioned this on the show before, but I'll remind listeners, and maybe you know of it, too. There's a famous skit by the Soviet comedian Arkady Rykin about shortage, where he says, and the final conclusion is, one of the things that shortage is, it's the glue that holds social relations together. And he says, imagine if there's no shortage, we would be an atomized, individualistic society without these relations, informal relations. And I found that incredibly insightful, even though it was a, you know, comedic act.
That's exactly, you know, a very important point, because a lot of people, when I did my research in post-socialist period, had that comment that blood has gone, and some people miss it, because for many people, what they did, it was friendship. Mm-hmm. Blood was what other people did. And that kind of misrecognition game, where if I do it, it's friendship, if you do it, it's blood,
right,
allowed those informal practices to be criticized and not really normalized, but also pervasive.
Right.
So that actually is the key of that paradox. That shops are empty, fridges are full.
Let's get into some of the issues that you bring up. Go ahead, Ruslana.
I wanted to bring us back to the title of the book, which is structured around the idea of pendulum and the paradox. So you talked a little bit about the various paradoxes. Could you tell us more how these two terms relate? Like, what do they allow you to do for the analysis of Russia?
I think it's a very good question. And I've contemplated originally, when I was thinking about this book, that maybe I should talk about problems versus puzzles, paradoxes versus practices. So I was guided by the folklore and that everyday wit that you find always in Russian sources. You know, the paradoxes, for example, Six Paradoxes of Socialism, have been very crucial for me to identify which practices are hidden, but hidden from the outsiders, but absolutely familiar and everyday for insiders. And that already is a paradox, because you have something like a know-how, which all insiders know, outsiders have no way of guessing. So how do you get to that reality, especially that these paradoxes capture something which is key to the transformation of society? With that, I would give you the seventh paradox, which is post-Soviet. Everyone voted in favor of the system, but it has collapsed anyway. That is, to me, is the biggest puzzle, you know, of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and how do we approach that fundamental shift, which actually generated huge debates around Russian studies, because we started thinking about Soviet era as a 70 years of an experiment. Mm-hmm. So hoping that Russia will become normalized, you know, returning to the linear projection of, you know, the world modernization.
The Soviet peers being cast as kind of a Sonderweg.
Exactly.
Throwing the Russian people and the world off if it's progressive rise to greatness or whatever one may say.
But what happened though, the AIDS paradox came through because the system has collapsed, but it has reemerged in 30 years.
One of the interesting things about your book is the form too, in that you include artwork by yourself. Each chapter starts with artwork and it references a song. The book actually has a soundtrack called The System Made Me Do It. Great name, by the way. And I want to have you talk about, and I should say that the music is composed by Benjamin Woodgates. I want to play a bit of one of the first songs, Particles/Waves. And this accompanies your chapter on Russian immigration. And the artwork you have is Scapegoat. So let me play like 20 seconds of the music. And then I'd like to have you talk about why you did this and describe the art and what the music means for your chapter on immigration. Okay, so what is this all about, to put it simply?
Well, first of all, thank you for asking this question, because of course, that is the key development of my own academic way of dealing with complexity of Russia, is to try to create shortcuts for explaining that complexity. So the idea of patterns, as I said, it came from the Global Informality Project, and I abstracted patterns of informal power or patterns of informality that I find everywhere. I've published 3 volumes of the encyclopedia, which actually stand alone. They are so fat, each volume. And what has been the easiest way for me to explain the unexplainable and to explain the complexity of informality around the globe is to distill the patterns and express them in art, which are pieces made of antique metal and tools and antique wood, something which is as ancient as the world, but they are not disappearing completely, but we need to find their place and we need to give them some attention. So the idea of the art collection on the patterns of informal power, and that was an exhibition in Paris that was called This System Made Me Do It, was actually quite literally that. I try to express the informal power that I know is really effective in so many societies around the globe and capture those elusive patterns of its operation. So the idea of a scapegoat, the work that you mentioned, and its relevance for the analysis of immigration from Russia comes hand in hand with a biblical pattern of a scapegoat, where community places its sins collectively on a particular scapegoat who then is pushed out of the community. What I see by looking in the text on the waves of immigration from Russia is exactly that. People who are not agreeable to Sistema, people who are not consensual, people who Sistema feels to be a threat to its own reproduction become pushed out. And of course, the main paradox of immigration is that those people who want to leave, they cannot. But those people who don't want to leave, they are pushed out of Russia. And that has been the way, actually, with every wave of immigration that I find about nine, historically speaking. And when I created that work, what I meant is exactly that periodic expulsion of people who would be a non-systemic opposition or a-systema people. Coming to music now, there is a fantastic review of this musical album that was actually commissioned to Benjamin Woodgates to try and capture these universal patterns and abstract them from the social context in music. And in this particular piece on particles and waves, we of course refer to the Schrödinger's cat paradox, where a particle could be a particle or a wave. And it's really, you know, like the cat could be both alive and dead. But it depends in quantum mechanics on the point of the observation. So in a way, that state of ambivalence or superposition, where you could be both a wave and a particle, get resolved at the point of observation. So the ambivalence as the unresolvable, unresolved state, which only gets pronounced or surfacing in a certain context-bound environment, is something that is central to the idea of the book, where I claim to be looking at, through the lens of ambivalence, on those paradoxes that we see in Russia. The music is written for two marimbas. And of course, the composer is probably the best person to explain how those particles and waves have been developing in music. But what the review says, that it's a mere four notes on the lower tone bars, generating rolling waves of sound, and their constant recombination creates an illusion of harmonic development where little has actually changed. But it's against that. Tiny particles flicker from the upper register until the polarity inverts and the two forces exchange roles completely, coexisting finally in a state of mutual ambivalence.